Okay. So we come on to the final lecture, if I think we're moving from the detectors to the early physics that might be seen. If we manage to detect input in the screen models. Here's the outline. See how far we can go in this last lecture. I will start again with an introduction, some general statements, some statements or some thoughts about the part on X values which are involved. Then I will spend most of the time on QCD physics actually. For two reasons. First one is because it will be among the most important things we will do next year. And it will be the processes with the highest cross-sections, what you are going to see next year. Second, minor important reason that I know it best. And then I will go to electroweak physics, and I probably have to skip in the end top physics. I have prepared a few slides for top physics, they are in your handouts, but I will concentrate on the first part. Also because if you're running at 7 TV, as we will see, the first thing will be the physics we can do. Again, I gave a few references here. Obviously, there are these TDRs both in CMS and Atlas, these big physics overviews. And these are the very useful resources if you want to find out what is the performance in a certain physics challenge in these experiments. Or, as an example, there's this web link where you can go and look at some very recent notes on certain physics channels. So let me start with a more general introduction. So this we have seen quite a number of times. In the first lecture, I gave you this two-line calculation where you can calculate what are the x values needed in order to produce a certain state of a mass, m. And let's compare now Tevatron and the LHC. So imagine we want to produce an object of 100 GeV or 5 TeV. And we make again a simple approximation that this state is produced in a collision of two partons which have similar x values. Okay. Then it's easy to see for an LHC center of mass energy of 14 TeV, in order to produce a 100 GeV object, you have to sample partons with an x value below 0.01, so 0.07. So pretty small x values. Whereas the Tevatron, in order to produce a 100 GeV object, you're sampling partons at an X value of 0.05, much larger. So you're sampling the proton at basically a completely different regime in X values. Now, if you go to a 5 TeV object, obviously you have to input a lot of energy in order to produce this 5 TeV object. So obviously you need a large X value and that LHC at 14 TeV. You need something like 0.3. So you're really absolutely in the valence quark regime. This is very simple, mostly the valence quarks and nothing else. Obviously, at the Tevatron, you don't have enough energy. So this is why it's empty. You cannot produce a 5 TeV object with a 2 TeV machine. So again, these are somehow rough numbers one can always keep in mind to get the feeling what kinematics are we sampling in a certain type of process. And as you know, the overall cross-section for a process for two hydrons going into some final state, where in fact the invariant mass of this final state might correspond to a certain mass here, is always given by this convolution of the parton distribution functions for finding these partons, giving the hard scattering, times the hard scattering cross-section at a certain hard scattering scale. So this Q square could, for example, be the mass of this object or the SL. And the big question is actually from where do we get these PDFs from? Because these functions are not calculable from first principles, so we have to get them from somewhere. And I will discuss this a little bit. And again, just as a reminder, people, you always hear talking about hard scattering. We are looking at hard scattering at the LHC. What does it mean? Well, it means processes with large momentum transfer, Q square. And of course, large is a very general statement. What does it really mean, large? something, let's say, above 20, 30 GeV or so, I would start to call large scale of scattering. Definitely, it should be something definitely larger than the scale where non-perturbative QCD effects become relevant. So if you're thinking about processes where the scale, the Q square involved, is of the order of a GeV or a few GeV, then definitely you're approaching a non-perturbative regime and you cannot talk about hard scattering. On the other hand, if people talk about hard scattering processes, they always talk about a very tiny fraction of the overall cross-section. Again, in the first hour, I've told you that the overall totally inelastic proton-proton cross-section is, if you talk about the non-diffractive part, it's about 70 millibar. And then a really nice example for a hard scattering process is the production of a W. The W, by its mass, defines a scale which is definitely much beyond the non-perturbative QCD scale. It defines a scale of the order of 100 GeV. The cross-section for this is 150 nanobar. So you're a million times smaller than the total inelastic non-diffractive cross-section. So hard scattering at LHC is a minute fraction of the overall cross-section. Also, this one should always remember. Now, you know probably that the PDFs, they are measured in another experiment. They have to be measured from data in a certain kinematic regime, and then we can use them, extrapolate them to the kinematic regime which is relevant at the LHC. Most of the information, not all, but most of the information is coming from the HERA data. Of course, some of the information is also coming from the Tevatron, for example, from the inclusive check cross-section, and so on. But most of the current input we have and most of the current knowledge we have is really coming from the HERA collider, so deep inelastic scattering of leptons on protons. And then, if you analyze this data in terms of PDFs, so you write down expressions where you express the structural functions, for example, for the proton in terms of PDFs, you can extract or fit these functions, extract this function from the data. Now, this is an example of such an extraction of these PDFs as a function of x value in the proton at a scale of 10 GeV Q squared. The Q, the scale, is square root of 10. And if you look at this, we see the following. Of course, as you know, around 0.3, this is the valence quark regime. We are really dominated by U and V valence quarks. And this is basically why I said that if you go into this regime, and if you want to produce a very heavy TV object, definitely you will need quarks from this region here. However, you've seen, if you produce a 100 GeV object, so we are doing electroweak physics at the LHC, we need x values below 0.01. 0.01 is here. So basically, doing electroweak physics at the LHC is sampling this x region here. So we are already very far in the sea, and we are basically relying on colliding gluons. And note also that this gluon PDF here is multiplied by a factor of 0.05. So in reality, this function here is 20 times larger. And this is the reason why you often hear people saying the LHC is a gluon-gluon collider. Basically, you're colliding gluon-gluon on each other. But be careful. The statement LHC is a gluon-gluon collider somehow is only correct if we talk about the probing electroweak scale physics. If you talk about probing TV scale physics, it's not necessarily true because you need the harder incoming photons. So just be aware of it. And the next issue is, we are here sitting at 10 GeV. Now the kinematics of the LHC is different. I mean, we are not at the 10 GeV scale, but the harder scale. And this is why this plot, which you probably often see, is a relatively important plot, and also a very, very useful plot. It shows the kinematics accessible by, let's say, the LHC, so proton-proton machine, the Tevatron, and the HERA. In order to get this region, just write down the simple kinematics. For example, at HERA, look what are the relative relations between, for example, the Q square, the S, the total center of mass energy, the X value of a scattering, the energy transfer of the electron, you will find simple relations between Q square, X, S, and Y, which is this energy transfer. And then from these very simple relations in deep inelastic scattering, you already see that HERA cannot cover an arbitrary range here, but has to sit in here. On the other hand, if we look at the kinematics at the LHC, I've shown you again this simple derivation, how to arrive at this formula. And now you can use this formula. For example, you can do the following. Again, here is the Q square of the scattering process, and here is the X value of the partons which are sampled. Now take an object to produce which has a mass of 100 GeV. And now it simply said Q square equals to M square. So in order to produce this object, we have to sit somewhere here on this line. Okay? And then lines of constant rapidity for producing this object are these here. So if the object has to be produced at central rapidity at zero, it has to be produced somewhere on this line. So if we want to have an object of 100 GeV produced at central rapidity, we can read off the X values for the partons. It's of the order of 0.01, this is what I said before. Now, if you produce if the same object at forward rapidity at 2, you find that you need one parton which is rather high in X value, and you need one parton which is rather low. And of course this gives you a certain, if the parton X's are not the same, then of course this will induce a boost, this will induce a rapidity of the object. So this is how you read this plot. And then you can go up to 1 dV scale to read off the same. You also see that the higher the mass of the object is, the less phase space you have in terms of rapidity. But again, this is the same thing which I said in the first hour. The higher the object, the mass of the object is, the more central it will be produced in the LHC. Okay. The basic question is the following. So we measure the PDFs in this kinematic regime here. And we have to bring them up here in this kinematic regime in order to plug them in the previous formula and make predictions. And then, from QCD, we know in principle how to transport the PDF from one kinematic regime into the other one by using the Stiglitz evolution equations. Then the question is, are they correct? I mean, will they work in order to really bring the PDFs from the header scale to the LHC scale? We will try to find out by simply measuring process and comparing to prediction and see if you have a problem there or not. The other obvious program will then be also try to constrain the PDFs from the LHC data themselves. Instead of relying only on the header data, we also will try to find out what are processes which are good to get new information on the PDFs. So try to measure them directly in the kinematic regime which is relevant for the LHC. So this is already one important, I think, program work for the LHC there. Now you have seen this table many times already. What is the rates of the processes we can expect? And typically, up to now, these tables have been shown for a center of mass energy of 40 dV. I don't repeat the numbers here, but I want to give one message. If you look at these numbers, you will find out that basically the statistical errors are negligible after a few days or months in most of the cases. Of course, not in all of them, because if you look for the Higgs or for a process in very small cross-section, it's not the case. But for standard model physics, for example, the statistical uncertainties are not really an issue. The issue of basically almost all the LHC physics is systematic uncertainties. And it is the systematic uncertainties which will determine the length of your PhD thesis, more or less. That's a fact of life. So this is one important message to keep in mind. And the other important thing is that actually we are not going to run at 14 TV if I'm asked to talk about early physics. But we will start at the lower center of mass energy. So thanks to a colleague, Frederik Romberg, a postdoc of mine, we produced this plot here, which is basically the same plot as I've shown in the first lectures, but now showing the evolution of the cross-section, for example, for inclusive W and Z cross-section for producing QCD jets with a transverse momentum above 100 GeV, for producing PB bar jets, top pair production, and the standard model Higgs production, 150 GeV. These are just inclusive cross-sections, leading order. You take Fitia, you run Fitia, and you get the inclusive cross-section without branching ratios and so on. What is interesting here is just evolution with the center of mass energy, and these are probably the center of mass energies we are going to sample in the next years. So apparently we'll start at 7 TeV, then go to 10 TeV, and hopefully later to 14 TeV. and you see a few things. You see that certain type of processes like chat production, TDVA production, and standard model Higgs production, they rise more steeply than W and Z production. This has something also to do with what are, again, the incoming BDFs necessarily lose this state. These are dot pair production, Higgs production, QCD jet production is more dominated by gluon scattering than W and Z production at leading order is basically quark, anti-quark scattering. And if you take now the numbers at the very center of mass energies, again, it's just leading order cross sections, it's no branching ratios included, and actually it's not the absolute number which maybe is so interesting, but what is interesting is look, what is the ratio of the production cross section at 7 dB compared to 14 dB? And if you know this ratio, now you can go back to all these tables you've seen during the last 10 years and get a simple scaling out of it to get the feeling how much more statistics really need to get the same result. So, and if you look at this scaling, you see the production of jets at more than 100 GeV has a cross section which is 5 times smaller at 7 dB than at 14 dB. The same thing you see for top production, a little bit less for Higgs production, whereas W and Z production, because this is rising less steeply, it's a factor of half. But these are the rough numbers. So it's very roughly, and I think this is something which was also pointed out by Keyes by showing the pattern luminosities, these quark-induced processes basically have a cross-section 2 times lower at 7 dB than at 14 dB, and gluon-induced processes have a cross-section roughly 5 times lower at 7 dB. And this then lets you conclude the following things. Early physics at 7 dB means obviously QCD, a lot of QCD, both at low and high dB, exclusive B production, because you get a lot of Bs, really a lot of Bs. You can do electroweak physics, meaning you can study W and Z production. For sure, you have enough, still enough statistics. You get some top, not too much, but still it should be okay. So everything works out fine. At 7 dB, we can do top production. This is also one important thing. At some stage, people are talking about the fact, why don't we run at 2 dB so we can test in the beginning, so we can compare to the Tevatron results. But if you think about that, look, the top cross-section is rising so steeply. If you run at 2 dB and get 200 inverse picovolum, we will not compare anything because we will have a few tops that we are at the same stage as Tevatron was in 2001, basically. And that would, from my point of view, would not have been useful at least to compare that type of physics. Now, since it is rising so steeply, we get tops already at a nice statistic. If you talk about the standard model Higgs, then at 7 dB with a few hundred inverse picovolum, there's nothing basically to do. I mean, nothing to do in terms of hoping for a discovery. But of course, you will get all your machinery running and all your machinery tested in order then to go on and do the search. But of course, nobody can exclude that we have some surprise. Even at 7 dB, we can have surprises for a new type of physics. But I will concentrate on the standard model physics here. So the first physics run in 2010 then should look something like this. So once we have 10 inverse picovolum, and also here, when exactly we are going to have 10 inverse picovolum really depends on the quality of the running of the machine, the efficiency of the detectors to take data, the efficiency of the experiments to reconstruct the data, understand the data, calibrate, and so on and so on. So what the exact time span is then to have this good data on your disk of your laptop and to produce the plot size is very difficult to predict. But I'm pretty sure that the effort which is going to be put in there is really enormous, definitely enormous. So it should be relatively quick, unless we discover problems in the detector or with the physics itself. So we will have plenty of minimum bias events, obviously. We just open the trigger, already the low luminosity we expect with 10 minimum picovolum, we get in millions of events. So then we get of the order of 10 to 20,000 Ws. This is really nice statistics, you can do already a lot of things. A few thousand Zs, this is also already something. For sure we should have a Z peak. We should see a Z peak by then. And a few hundred semi-atomic top pair events. So this is not too much, but many people will start to look for it. And with accumulating more and more data, people will start to measure more and more precisely the rates, use them also for calibration processes. Now, this 100 inverse Beaker one, so hopefully we are somewhere in the second half or the middle of 2010 or second half of 2010. Some other interesting processes become available, like W plus jet production now. You will have, if you start in, to be able not to look only inclusively at W and Z production, but separate out sub-process. These are very important for many reasons. On the one hand, it will be used for jet calibration, as I will show. Now, W and plus jet production is very, very important for a lot of new physics, as it is in a very important background. In many, many searches, it's basically the most important background. For example, for missing a decalibration for all kinds of SUSE searches. And with 100 inverse Beaker one, one can start to look at the production more generally of inclusive leptons, of inclusive dileptron production, which is also a general topology for SUSE searches. One will start to look at photons and diphoton triggers. Why diphotons or triggers? Diphoton trigger, for example, will be a very important trigger for the Higgs search to photons. Although with 100 inverse Beaker one, you're never going to see a Higgs into photons, but you have to start as soon as possible to understand your trigger completely. And that early on with more data, you know what is going on in this type of triggers. And then you go on. Now, if you go up to 1 inverse femto one, of course, then the statistics for standard model physics are perfectly, well, are really, really high to do precision measurements. Now, we will not reach 1 inverse femto one in 2001. But we will have a lot of standard model studies, very precise determinations of the cross-section PDF studies, as I pointed out, a lot of QCD studies, and we will do extensive Monte Carlo tuning. Now, the tuning will also happen already here at these stages. Because with 1 inverse femtobahn, actually, I shaded it out a little bit, because, of course, the Higgs, even with 1 inverse femtobahn, is somehow at the limit, although the Higgs to WW with 1 inverse femtobahn definitely you can compete with what the Devon is doing now, and actually be a bit better. Not for the Higgs to gamma gamma, and Higgs to ZZ is also still not really possible to do. For Higgs to ZZ, you definitely need more than 1 inverse femtobahn. Now, I also shaded out SUSE BSM searches, although this is a little bit more difficult to make general statements, since there are so many topologies, so many different scenarios. In some of them, you can get surprises with rather little collected luminosity. So I guess you're hearing all about this here. You're going to hear in a lecture next week on the experimental searches for BSM. Well, why standard model physics? Why to do standard model physics? Well, first of all, we will not have anything else to do, so we are forced to do standard model physics. But of course, it's very, very important in its own right. It's interesting in its own right, because we are going to test the standard model at an energy scale where it has not been tested before. And we are going to probe theoretical predictions in a Q-square range where the predictions have not been probed before. So for me, this is already interesting enough. The other important thing is, if you're not able to measure standard model processes and to understand them in the sense that we are getting precise cross-section measurements, we can compare them with, let's say, for example, higher order QCD perturbative calculations and get meaningful comparisons. If you're not able to do that, then we are not allowed to talk about new physics searches. Definitely, we're not allowed to talk about that. Everybody who will talk about new physics searches is not able to measure the W cross-section, W plus check cross-section, will be silenced. I mean, you have to. I mean, so what means understanding the detector? Well, the standard model processes are very useful actually to calibrate a lot of things. Now, the obvious example, the most famous example, is the Z decator to leptons. You measure it, for example, to measure the energy scale in your electromagnetic calorimeter. If you have electrons, in this case, you can do the relative calibrations in different regions in your calorimeter, and so on. And as I mentioned, W plus jet production is very important to understand the backgrounds, to tune the Monte Carlo models, to check if at the LHC energy scales, things like, for example, Alpgen, which combines leading order matrix elements with Barton shower, still does a good job. to, for example, predict the shape of cross sections which involve W plus 2, 3, 4 jets and so on. Then, again, we should be able to constrain PDFs, or relative PDFs, and as I will mention also, some of these processes, since actually the theoretical predictions are known pretty well, they can be used also to measure luminosity. This is the master equation. This is your master equation. And this is the equation you should always basically keep in mind when you study and when you plan a new measurement, a new study. Basically, this is the equation which is at the heart of almost every analysis. You want to measure a cross-section. The cross-section is given by an observed number of events. And this observed number of events is basically defined, for example, by a set of selection cuts. You have to subtract off background events. You have to divide by the efficiency to actually select these events, and you have to divide by the luminosity. Now let's look at the individual factors. What are all the things you have to think about for every factor? Now up here, you have to take some decision, first of all. If there is n observed, what does it mean? Is it absolute rates? Are you interested in an absolute rate? Do you really need to know the absolute rate? Maybe it's enough to know a relative rate. The relative rate of one process with respect to another process, which you are able to measure very well. So sometimes, in fact, I will show you, it's better not to measure absolute rates because you can do better from the experimental point of view, from the systematics. Then is the question, are you interested only in an inclusive cross-section, an overall counting experiment, or do you want to measure shapes? Do you want to measure kinematical distributions? Kinematical distributions typically tell you more. Then, where do you get this number from? Are you forced to take this number from a Monte Carlo simulation? If yes, then you are a little bit in trouble because you will have to do a lot of convincing work and a lot of cross-checks to make sure that the Monte Carlo really gives you a good prediction. You're lucky if you find methods to actually get this number from the data themselves by some trick, at least. By some clever method. I hope I can show something at the very end as a principle. Then, when you measure these numbers and you measure distributions, you have to be careful with things like resolution effects, energy scale effects. I will show concrete examples for jet cross-section measurement. And if you're looking for a search here, be careful when you calculate the signal significance. Be careful if you have statistical and a lot of systematic uncertainties involved, and be careful if the signal over background ratio is around one or smaller. Because then it's very easy to make stupid mistakes if you don't take into account correctly the systematic uncertainties. Now the efficiency. There are a lot of efficiencies you have to control. There's a trigger efficiency. Somehow you have to find out what is actually a trigger efficiency. And this is why people try to look at the same signal obtained from different triggers, because then you can cross-check your efficiency. Then there are things like isolation cuts and the efficiency related to isolation cuts. In many searches for new physics, you require, especially in the Higgs sector, you require that there is no jet in the event, in addition, for example, to leptons or photons, which might come from the Higgs, for example. For example, this is used to reduce top background, because tops give you always a lot of jets. Now, if you require that there is no jet in the event, be careful, because now you're testing QCD in a region where low PT jets are produced. Because if you say, I don't want to have a jet in my event which has more than 20 GeV, you are testing QCD predictions in a region of 0 to 20 GeV and around 20 GeV. And there, very often you find out that fixed order perturbative predictions don't give you a very reliable prediction. You need to have resummation and so on. So be careful if you have such critical cuts, meaning be careful if you cut down the phase space into very restricted regions. Because the theoretical predictions sometimes might be good if you just talk about the inclusive thing, the whole phase space, but they might not be good if you look at very, very specific regions of phase space. So be careful with strong cuts. And then there are these methods now very widely used and talked about, like tag and probe, in order to get the efficiency, in fact, not from the Monte Carlo, but from the data themselves. Now there's the luminosity number. The luminosity number is given to you by somebody, hopefully it will be given by a machine, with a certain systematic uncertainty. What is the systematic uncertainty? In the beginning, people say it will be something like 10%. Maybe we can do better. Maybe we can reach 5% or so. Would be nice to go better, because otherwise, if you can do a fantastic measurement in all these things here, you're the most clever person in the world, you manage to get the measurement at a few percent precision, then in the end you have to plug in this number and you kill yourself with a 10% uncertainty in order to get the cross section. It's not very satisfactory, I would say, because you don't learn really anything new. Once you have done the job and measured the cross section, you can compare it to a theoretical prediction. And as we've seen, the theoretical prediction is a convolution of the PDF and the hard scattering cross section. Now this you either get from higher order calculations, and in some cases, as I will show, we even have next to next to leading order calculations for WZ production, for example. Then these are either implemented in a Monte Carlo, hopefully, because then you have an easier job to get numbers out. And then it could be that part of these calculations are implemented in the Monte Carlo, or certain types of high order corrections are implemented in the Monte Carlo, and then you add in a button shower and so on and so on. But this you have heard, I guess, from Jostrand. You have to compute with the PDFs. As I said, they have to come from somewhere. They come from PDFs fits, which rely on data from all over the world, basically. But these also have uncertainties. Then this is a big discussion going on now for years, and it's still going on, how actually define correctly, let's say, the uncertainties which are related to the PDFs here, and to include them in the overall uncertainty for the theoretical prediction. Because once you have that, only then you can compare your theoretical, your experimental measurement, which has a certain uncertainty, and compare it to the prediction, which also has an uncertainty. Don't forget this here. And only then you can check, is there consistency or not? And then you're done, and you can start the write-up of your thesis. Now, the measurement of soft processes will be the first thing, really, really the first thing. Again, because this is just coming in. It will just be pouring in terms of data, low-PT physics. I found out by looking at the slides of Sjostrand that basically he has talked about all this. And he has talked about the underlying events and so on. So I think I can skip a lot of here. And he talked about multiple button interactions and how you define it, at least in the current models, at least how he has implemented it in the future. There's one thing I would really point out once more. Be careful. There are people who tend to confuse the underlying event with minimum bias. The underlying event is not minimum bias. Okay, this is not the same thing. I try to explain your minimum bias just in terms of triggers, just in terms of data taking. You open up your trigger, you see what's coming in, that's minimum bias. And it is soft proton-proton interactions. Now, it turns out that the underlying event, somehow scattering, most of it is also soft physics. I mean, stuff from initial state radiation and so on, the remnants, they are related to soft physics. But they are not exactly the same physics as you would see just by looking at minimum bias events. So taking minimum bias events to measure exactly the underlying event will be wrong, because, and I think Jürgen has talked about it, the underlying event, really, the exact, let's say, picture of the underlying event depends also on the scale of the hard scattering. It gives you a certain pedestal effect. The overall energy involved in the process depends also what is going on at the hard scattering. So be careful with this. And don't confuse the two things. Now, Jostrand has also explained how it is measured at the moment, for example, at the telotron. The basic issue is the following. If you look at hard scattering events, you have to find a way in order to separate out particles which are produced, which come from the hard scattering, to those which really come from the underlying event. This is why people look at some hard scattering process, and then you look at some other regions of phase space where you're pretty sure that the particles which are in that phase space are coming from the underlying event. And the message I want to give here are two. First, these are the main observables really measured. You want to know what is the number of charged particles per unit rapidity per phi, per unit azimuthal angle, so the charge density. This is a very important measurable quantity, and which can be put into Monte Carlo models. And the other measurable quantity is simply what is the total sum of transverse momentum produced in a certain phase space per unit rapidity per phi. this is what is going to be measured. And from the experimental point of view, the important statement is here. I've shown in the first hour that if you think about our trackers, they are pretty large. So the average PT of particles in soft, very soft interactions is 500 to 800 MeV or so. So you have a lot of loopers, and actually a lot of very soft particles. And the reconstruction algorithms for tracks and so on, at least in the early stages, they have been optimized, let's say, from about 1 GeV or the 800 MeV upwards. So they are not very efficient in reconstructing very low PT particles. So you're not reconstructing the charged particle spectrum to PT zero. On the other hand, the charged particle spectrum is very steeply falling. What does it mean? If we want to know the charged particle density, but we measure it only to a PT, let's say, from 800 MeV upwards, we are not measuring a large fraction of the phase space. Now, if you use a Monte Carlo to extrapolate to zero, what you're measuring is what is the Monte Carlo value, not what the data is. If your extrapolation factor is huge. So that is why a lot of effort is going in a collaboration in order to try to extend the reconstruction of charged particles down to much lower PT values, because then the extrapolation to zero is less dramatic, and then you're measuring really something what's coming from the data and not something what is coming from the Monte Carlo. This is an example of projected measurement, for example, by CMS of the charged particle density as a function of the rapidity. This is the reconstructed data. That's if you use, for example, previous data, and the shaded band is the uncertainties. And what the people expect is that the uncertainties will be of the order of up to 10%. But here, they only use a few thousand good events, a few days of running, basically. Get this immediately. I mean, just the data. Then you have to do, of course, this. So this can be done quickly. The issue will be, in fact, to get this down to very low PTs. And one trick to do is not try to reconstruct a track in the whole tracker. Just look at the pixel. Just look at the pixel and see, are in the three layers three hits which are consistent with a charged particle. In this way, forgetting about all the rest, just looking for triplets of pixel hits, actually one can go to low PT with a reasonable efficiency. So this is pretty new now, isn't it? And similarly, this is a plot which basically shows what is the underlying event. So what is the charged particle density away from the hard scattering object, which might be a jet, independence of the jet PT. And you see, if the jet PT increases, also the density away from the jet increases. This is just what is enclosed on the Vedeschi effect. And this is what tells you that the underlying event in hard scattering event is not the same necessarily as the minimum bias event. They probably find a pedestal of somewhere around here. And one thing which I start to be a little bit worried about, and I think the Tevatron will give us a lot of still input in there, is the issue of multiple button interaction. I think up to recently, we have not really thought much about multiple button interactions. We have more or less ignored it. Now the Tevatron has, I think, evidence that in order to describe particle production in their data, they need contribution from multiple button interactions. So the question is, again, what is the extrapolation to LHC energies, and how important will these effects be at the LHC? And the question will really be, how often should multiple button interactions, for example, give us additional digest events which come from a second pattern scattering, even with PTs of the order of 20 to 30 GeV. They will not be probably much larger. But if you get a higher rate than expected of additional jets in this range, then analysis which rely on jet vetoes, where you say, I don't want an additional jet of 20 or 30 GeV in my event, but I get them by multi-button interaction, I will throw them all away. So I have a real problem with my signal efficiency. So this is why I start to be a little bit worried about it. It will be a very important thing to tune very quickly on if we have tools to do that. And now I raise basically the PT of the events. I go above 30, 40 GeV and so on. So let's talk about jets. And basically jets are produced by a lot of different types of particle-particle scattering. In the T channel, in the S channel, quark scattering, gluon quark scattering, gluon gluon scattering. Again, if you talk about jets with a PT of 50 to 100 GeV or so, then we are mostly discussing gluon gluon scattering, and most of the outgoing jets will be gluons. And the question is really, I mean, we have this picture here, we produce gluons or partons. They radiate in some parton shower, so you get more partons in some stage in the evolution, then they transform into neutral hadrons, but not neutral charged hadrons, which then decay further, and we measure then some energy deposits concentrated in some clusters in the detector, which we then call jets. And the issue is how to relate the observation at this level to the hot scattering here. And basically, it boils down to the question, what is a jet after all? You can, just looking at the event displays, of course, you can say a jet is a cluster, a spray of particles, or a flow of energy in a restricted region of phase space. And if you look at some simulations, it really looks like this. If you cut out the very low PT particles, the particles coming from a jet in QCD, they are really well defined in phase space. But of course, we need an algorithmic definition. We cannot implement such a phrase in our reconstruction algorithm. So here's a short digression on jet algorithms, also because there has been a lot of development during the last 2-3 years on this subject. Now, if you look at the Devatron events, or Devatron jet production, and you look at their pictures, this is a picture from D0, where we see the jets, a dijet event, as measured in the D0 liquid argon calorimeter. Here is a lot of energy deposits here. Or as CDF often presents their jet events, this is just the calorimeter folded out. These are the cells. This is pseudorapidity, this is phi. And we look where are the energy deposits of a multi-jet event. This could be a 3 or maybe 4 jet event, depends what is your threshold. You see that the energy is really very much confined in, let's say, circular regions in this eta phi plane. So talking about the cone prescription in order to define jets appears to be rather natural. It's just because this is what we see, basically. And you can get a similar natural picture if you look at, let's say, the perturbative picture. You have outgoing partons, which then ferment. Now, fermentation occurs at the typical scale of the order of lambda QCD, or let's say 1 GeV. So if you have an outgoing parton with a certain transverse momentum, fermentation cannot suddenly give you a PT of 20 GeV. I mean, this is just not happening at this energy scale. So the results of the fermentation or hydrolyzation, they should have a relative PT to the original parton, which is relatively small, of the order of 50 GeV. So they should stay in a region which I can define again by drawing a cone around the original direction of the parton. So again, it seems rather natural. What are the requirements for a jet algorithm? First of all, it should be, if you have an algorithm, you should be able to apply it on all kinds of different inputs. You should be able to apply it in a QCD calculation. So the QCD calculation or QCD Monte Carlo gives you as output for every event a number of partons with a certain momentum. And you should be able to run the algorithm on this output. You should be able to run it on the output of media, which gives you hadrons with their momenta. You should be able to run it on simply the list of clusters of the calorimeter energy deposits. So it should be equally well applicable. And hopefully, in all these cases, it should give you the same jet. I mean, I'm talking about an event in a simulation which first gives you partons, then hadrons, then simulated clusters. It always should give you the same jet. It should be independent of the very large details of the experiment. It should not really depend on that. Otherwise, it's also not clear how this would affect just running the algorithm on a Monte Carlo pattern level calculation. It should be easy to implement. This sounds trivial, but it is something to be considered. And it has not been always the case, I think, in the past. And if you try to look at, let's say, some Tevatron publications, also from Run 1, and try to write down or code the JET algorithm which was used there, we find out that it's not straightforward to implement such a method. It's not straightforward. And here's the most important, I think, condition. It has to be infrared and collinear safe. What does that mean? Well, it means that if there's a little change in your configuration of input particles, let's say if a particle, you replace a particle with a certain PT by two particles which are just collinear but with half the PT, basically the JET configuration which is found should not change. Why is this? Well, from the an experimentalist would say, I don't care. I mean, I still run my algorithm and okay, I find something. But from the QCD point of view, it makes a big difference because it could be that such a change suddenly induces that your perturbative QCD calculations, if they have higher order corrections, simply give you infinity as a result. Because if this happens and the algorithm and the JET topology changes, you will not anymore cancel singularities which appear on real radiation terms with those which appear on actual correction terms. So if you have higher order QCD calculations, you better make sure you run an infrared safe algorithm. Otherwise, it could happen that you simply get none, not a number, as output. And then you cannot compare your measurement to the prediction. That's not nice. So, and of course, the other evident condition is that the algorithm in the end should give you a pretty close correspondence between the energy and the momentum of the original pattern and the energy and the momentum of the JET you find in a detector. Now, here's, let's say, the simplest example of a cone algorithm and what is the algorithmic flow. I don't go into the details. Originally, the idea has been the following. Originally, the idea has been also to speed up the thing, to say, let's start from a few seeds. So not from the beginning, don't look at all the clusters in your calorimeter, just take those which are above a certain transverse energy. Okay? And then actually start your algorithm from the cluster or from the tau which has the most transverse energy. And then, in the following, you put the cone around this seed. Then you look, are there other towers following inside my cone? If yes, I recompute the average direction and the average energy of this cone. And I might find that the new direction actually shifts a little bit. So now I'm here. Now this tower, which previously was not in the cone, suddenly enters the cone, so I have to recalculate the direction, the energy, and so on. And I do it as long as my cone is not stable in direction. And at the end, I might end up with a certain set of cones. There's one problem. If you start with seeds, you immediately have the problem that your algorithm might not be infrared collinear stable. Because what happens if you replace your seed, which is above a threshold, with two seeds, which are just collinear, but both of them are below the threshold? Then you start your algorithm in a completely different way, and it could happen that your algorithm will find a completely different JET configuration. And then, not a number, if you have higher order calculation. And this was a long sort of problem. On the other hand, if you say, okay, let's forget about seeds, let's run the algorithm on all clusters, then there was a speed problem. Just an algorithmic problem, I mean, to find all possible configurations. But fortunately, a few years ago, Gavin Salami and collaborators, they have found, let's say, a mathematical implementation of the idea to find all possible codes in the game. And this then defined this syscone algorithm, which is an infrared collinear safe algorithm. This is the seedless cone algorithm. So basically, now we have a cone algorithm which is infrared collinear safe. The midpoint algorithm which was used in the Tevatron is not infrared collinear safe if you go beyond a certain order of perturbations here. Or JET2 is not infrared safe. Iterative cone is used in CMS at the trigger level is not infrared safe. Another way of finding infrared safe algorithms is by using these iterative algorithms, like the KT algorithm, where basically you say I define a metric in my configuration space. Let's say I look at the transverse momentum between two particles. If the transverse momentum is smaller than the value, I combine these two particles in the new one. And then I just iterate on all of them, and in the end, I will end up with a certain configuration. This is the KT algorithm. And the KT algorithm is also infrared collinear safe. In the beginning, especially at run 1 at Tevatron, it has not been used because people said, Well, in fact, the original implementations were just too slow, and there is a problem of, let's say, defining what is the contribution from the underlying event and pileup and so on, because the iterative, that this KT algorithm will give you typically shapes of jets which are very irregular, contrary to a cone algorithm which in principle should give you areas of jets which are very regular, should be a cone. Also, there has been algorithm, people found out that in fact I can write different variants of this metric. Depending on some power I introduce here, I either get the KT algorithm, or I get the, what is called the K-Machrafen algorithm, or very recently I can get the, what is called anti-KT algorithm by simply putting P to minus 1 instead of to 1 in the KT case. What is this? Well, the anti-KT algorithm from the principle is the same thing. You have a metric, you combine two articles according to the metrics, and you do this iteratively. The only thing difference is the anti-KT first basically clusters all the soft particles to the hard particles. Whereas the KT algorithm first clusters all the soft particles together and then starts to look for the hard particles. And the anti-KT does it the other way around. And it is fast. Now also, Charlie and Salam have found ways of implementing this algorithm in a fast way. So there's no argument anymore not to use them. And in fact, the LSE experiments are running them as base algorithms in the reconstruction codes. And this is a nice plot because it shows what are the jet areas. So what is the area covered by a jet at the end of the algorithm? For the KT, as I said, the areas can be very irregular. Then you have to find clever ways in order to subtract the underlying event. The K-Machrafen algorithm gives you also very irregular shapes. The syscone, since it's a cone algorithm, in principle it should give you very cone-like shapes. It's not always the case, this is because there's also a splitting and merging component. So if two jets are overlapping, then you have to define what part of the jet belongs, what part of the energy belongs to one jet, and what part belongs to the other. At the end of the algorithm, you can destroy your nice cone shape. Whereas the anti-KT, surprisingly, being a KT type algorithm gives you suddenly fantastically nice cone type shapes. This is why this anti-KT algorithm becomes more and more popular now in CMS and Douglas. Yeah. Now the question is the following. In the past it was done like this. You try to measure, for example, what is the average density of energy in your event by looking, for example, at minimum bias. Even then, if this might not be completely correct, but you just look at minimum bias event, what is the average density per unit rapidity? And then if you have nice areas of your jets, you don't have to do a lot of things, you just know what is the area by taking the cone size, r squared pi, multiply by the average density, so you know how much energy you will have in your jet if you subtract. If you have irregular shapes, you somehow have to find ways which are easy and quick in order to get the area somehow. Again, there is an algorithm which is now implemented in this fast jet package. This, for even very irregular shapes, gives a very clever method to get this area. But before that, it was not clear how to get this area easily. That's basically a simple geometric problem. And the other things, in fact, as I just talked, is this subtraction of the underlying event. One statement I want to put here is interesting. It turns out that contributions from the underlying event and from hadronization effects tend to cancel. So the underlying event somehow sometimes adds in additional energy to your jet if you just compared to the Parton energy, whereas the hadronization effects take a little bit of energy out. This is because some of the hadrons, after all, after fermentation, go out of the cone. So if you take both effects into account and then compare your jet energy to the originally measured jet energy, then the overall correction is not the big action. So, end of the digression, which was already too long. Speed up a little bit. What do you want to measure in QCD? What is one of the most important cross-sections is the inclusive jet cross-section. So the cross-section for producing jets as a function of their transverse energy. One of the reasons, of course, is to test perturbative QCD, because we are talking about the measurement which scans 7, 8, 9 orders of magnitude. do. This is already amazing. Then the other thing is, if you look at the tail, this is where you look for deviations. For example, because of contact interaction, because of compositeness. Now what you calculate in perturbative QCD is a differential cross-section in ET and rapidity. And what you measure is, in principle, is just a counting experiment. Once you have defined your bins, you do a counting in every bin, you divide by the width of the bin, you divide by the width of rapidity range. Again, you divide by the efficiency, and you might need the luminosity. So it's a counting experiment. So it seems pretty easy. In principle, it's easy. And statistically, it's also easy, because if you look at the cross-section, even as with one inverse picobar, now I think this was either with 10 TV or 40 TV, the statistical errors are very, very small, up to very high transverse energy. So you pretty quickly cover, statistically, a region which is already much larger than what can be covered by a Tevatron. There's one yellow range, and this is the jet energy scale uncertainty, and I come to that immediately. So statistically, this is not the problem. So the real problem is the energy scale. And the energy scale calibration is so important. Why? It's pretty simple. If you look at the differential cross-section, it falls like a power law. It's a power which is somewhere around 6. It's actually not exactly 6. The exact power depends where you're sitting here. It can even be bigger than 6. Whenever you have a cross-section, this is not related just to jets. Whenever you have a cross-section which falls like a power law with a large power, it's obvious that the relative uncertainty on your rate here is 6 times the relative uncertainty on your x value here. So every error you make on the x value here will induce you a 6 times larger area in counting. You cannot do anything about this. It's just back to plug. This is what I told also for the muons, for example. The muons have also very steep rate. That's why I said resolution problems induce even a small effect here induces a big effect on the wire. That's it. One tries to ignore it, but it's not possible. The problem is the following. Even an uncertainty of 5% on your jet energy scale gives you a 30% cross-section uncertainty. 30% is a lot, and in fact, to reach 5% will take a lot of effort. In the beginning, it will probably be bigger. So then you understand suddenly why the uncertainties here are so big. And remember, this is a logarithmic scale. So it will be a little bit less dramatic. And the other effect is energy resolution. Because what you really measure, is not the number of jets which had a certain true energy, but you measure the convolution of the number of jets with a certain true energy times some smearing effect, because your detector will smear the true energy to the left or to the right. And again, you have a problem. So this resolution term might be simple, might just be a Gaussian. Actually, it's a Gaussian plus some non-Gaussian tails. The problem is, again, that the spectrum is very steeply falling. So even if, on average, you smear the same amount to the left and the right, since the spectrum is so steeply falling, once you go to the right, you put much too much events in the higher bins. So basically, you distort your spectrum. So the error you make on the higher part of the spectrum is much bigger. If you put something on the left, it doesn't really matter so much, because there you have anyway a lot of events. So a little bit more or less, it's not important. So you have to correct your spectrum because of these resolution effects. One way to do it is simply is just try to define bins which are at least as large as this one. Then you're already a little bit safe. But if the resolution is bad, and you end up with two bins in your measurement, you will not be very happy. So you have to consider resolution effects. These are projections of jet measurements in CMS. Sorry about that. Again, to not show too many CMS plots. But the message would be the same for Atlas. This is for 10 TeV. For 10 inverse picoband, one can do a pretty nice measurement from the terms of statistical error. This is compared to an next to leading auto zero prediction. The data points here are simulated data using Pythia. From this, for example, you see that Pythia and next to leading order QCD are not the same thing. Because Pythia does not have next to leading order QCD in it. That's why the red line is not on the data. It's not that we do not manage to measure the same thing which we have put in the simulation. And here you see that if there would be a new physics like a contact interaction with a typical scale of 3 TeV, this would start to give you data which deviate starting from 700, 800 GV or onwards. And if these are really your uncertainties, and you see a deviation like this, then you start to be interested. But you have better make sure that you really understand your jet energy scale here, because a completely wrong jet energy scale in the tail here can easily produce such an effect. Very easy. And these are the systematic uncertainties. So these are the experimental systematic uncertainty. The yellow is the total. The luminosity is just this 10% or 5%. It's not important. Energy resolution effects can be folded out. So what is remaining is basically all jet energy scale. So you see, for example, a 10% jet energy scale uncertainty gives you a 60% uncertainty on the cross section. That's it. All the other things are much less important. Now let's compare it to theoretical uncertainties. The theory prediction is dominated actually by the PDF uncertainties. The PDF uncertainty is dominating over most of the phase space. It's biggest at very high PT. And that's because we don't know, for example, what is really the PDF for a gluon at very high X. We don't know it very well. But this contributes in this region, that's why the uncertainty is very low. What do we learn from these two plots? From these two plots, we learn that with the early inclusive jet cross-section data, we will not be able to constrain the PDFs very much, because the experimental uncertainties are bigger than this. You can start to constrain the PDFs once the picture is inverted. If the experimental uncertainties are smaller than the PDF uncertainties, then you can feed these measurements into a global PDF feed and then get better PDFs. So in the beginning, we will have to live, let's say, with the experimental uncertainty and just compared to theory that we cannot use the constraint. How do you get the jet energy scale? By using, of course you can use the Monte Carlo, but in order to use the data, you can look for some processes which give you some constraints. The simplest case is quark-quark scattering, where you get one photon and one gluon. This gluon will give you a jet, the photon will give you a photon in a detector, and by momentum conservation, they will be back-to-back in their PT. So they should have, in the simplest leading order picture, they should have the same PT. So the photon, we think we can measure the energy of the PT with a few percent precision. So then we just balance, we measure this PT, and then we say we have to correct whatever is measured here for that PT, and then we get the calibration of the gluon jet. So the idea is simple, and an example here is from the zero. This is a jet which is balanced by a nice photon. And this is actually carried out, but of course the devil is in the details. You have to reconstruct the photons, you have some biases in the photons. Nature is not like this. Nature gives you additional radiation and so on. So the balancing in PT is not perfect. You have to try to get it as perfect as possible. And then, if one tries to do this type of calibration, in fact, if you plot the transverse momentum of the jet before calibration over the transverse momentum of the photon, we get this curve here. And this is exactly this response curve which I've shown you yesterday. This is basically what the relation of the measured jet energy to the true energy as a function of the jet energy. And as I said, for low transverse energies of the jets, we only measure half of the real jet energy. And this is found by looking at the photon. Okay, and now if we measure these points here with the photons, we can use this difference here as a calibration factor. We apply it on the jets, and then we get calibrated jets. In fact, the whole thing is much more complicated. This is what the experiments have in mind to do. Actually, there are much more steps you have to pass through before, in order to go from a reconstructed jet, this is just the energies coming out from the calorimeter, up to a calibrated jet. The first thing what you typically do is you apply an algorithm which subtracts off offset energy, so pile-up energy and so on. This is the first thing you get rid of. Then the second thing you do typically is at least try to have the same response of jets at different rapidities. A jet with a certain transverse momentum has a certain response in the central calorimeter, but not necessarily the same in the forward region. Why? Could be that the forward calorimeter is a different one, but a jet in forward direction with the same PT has much larger energy. And if it's the energy which is measured in the calorimeter. And if the energy response is non-linear in the calorimeter, which is the case, then your response of the JetBD will be different. So the first thing, you just flatten out by calibrating the rapidity dependence. Well, how do you do this? You look at dijet events, where you just have two jets. You measure the PT of the one, and then you say, by momentum conservation, the PT of the other one should be the same. And by balancing this, you get a calibration. And then once you have this relative calibration, you apply, for example, this photons calibration to get the absolute scale, right? Now you have calibrated jets, which correspond somehow to the jet at the particle level. It could be that you want to go back to the jet energy before hydrogenization. Okay, then you have to use Monte Carlo. There's no way that we can go in the data from hydrons to partons, because we cannot measure partons. So all the rest is basically Monte Carlo correction. Now, on day one, all what we have is Monte Carlo. So on day one, we will use Monte Carlo corrections to which will be applied on our data in order to get corrected jets. That's for sure. Then, with more data, we can start to use this data-driven method. So we will get photon jet events, and we can start to apply this method I've shown before. With a lot of data, after many years, we will have had time to tune our Monte Carlo, so we can make sure that our Monte Carlo really describes our jets. And once we are pretty confident in our Monte Carlo, we actually can go back and use the Monte Carlo again to get the corrections. Why is that nicer? That's nicer because the Monte Carlo is much more flexible. The data-driven methods are always biased, because with these photons, for example, you can only go up to a certain PT before you run out of statistics, whereas the jets, you measure up to 1 TeV. With the Monte Carlo, you just extrapolate, okay? Or if suddenly you decide to change your jet algorithm from one cone size to another cone size, either you have to repeat all your data-driven methods, because those have been defined for a certain cone size, or you just run the Monte Carlo. So that's why Monte Carlo is much more flexible. And in the end, probably we will use it again. But we cannot use it, let's say, in the intermediate stage, because it will not be reliable enough. And finally, what can we do with dijets? Well, dijets also carry a lot of information. One thing is the following. One interesting thing is to measure the cross-section as a function of the dijet invariant mass. Again, this is a distribution which is useful for testing QCD, but which is also useful for looking, for example, for dijet resonances. So some Kaluza-Klein towers could appear here. But you have the same problem. Of course, if the inclusive jet cross-section has the problem of the jet energy scale systematic, and certainly also the mass has it, obviously, because the mass gets the input from two jets. And in fact, the uncertainty is of the order of 50% here, the relative uncertainty, completely dominated by the jet energy scale. Now, what is a clever method to get around it? And one clever method is to look at the ratio of observers. In fact, you can do the following. You measure the ratio of the cross-section when both jets are very central over the ratio when both jets are very forward. The first thing is, this ratio is sensitive to the production of heavy resonances, because the heavy resonances only are produced centrally. QCD produces jets centrally and forward. The other thing is that your jet energy uncertainty cancels out, because it's more or less the same centrally and forward. And if you look at this ratio, in fact, the uncertainty from the jet energy scale is reduced by a lot. It's only of the order of 5% or so. So this is a very nice example where ratios help you a lot. And other observables, which again are type of ratios, but which also give you information on, let's say, the structure of the event, are event shapes, like thrust. This is basically calculating what is the topology of your event. Is it two jet-like, or are there many jets which look like a symmetric event, and so on. And you can plot the distribution of such a topological variable. And since in this definition, the transverse momenta appear upstairs and downstairs, scale uncertainty simply cancel out. So again, it's much better than looking at an absolute cross-section which depends absolutely on the PT. And other things which people will look at the jet structure. Basically, you have a jet, but then you start to look inside the cone and look how is the energy distributed within the cone. And this distribution depends what is actually at the origin of the jet. Has it been a quark or has it been a gluon? The quarks and gluons have different energy distribution within the jet. And in this way, we might be able to measure the relative fractions of quarks and gluons. Now, I have to be just a few statements on W and Z production. Actually, these are among the most precise processes we know for the LHC, because they are known to up to next leading order QCD. So people have calculated a few years ago even this next leading order correction. What does this mean? It means that these radix uncertainties, for example, from scale variation, become very small. This is the prediction for producing a Z as a function of its rapidity. And this is the leading order prediction and the theoretical uncertainty, huge. Then you go to next leading order, the green one, much better, but still a certain uncertainty. Then you go to next leading order contribution, the band is very, very small. In fact, the uncertainties are at the level of 1% or so. 1% for me is just amazing for a QCD prediction in the LHC, but this is what comes out. Okay? You can go even below 1% if you look at ratios. For example, you can look at the cross-section ratio of W plus production or W minus. We can measure this because we can measure the sign of the lepton coming from the W. And if you measure this cross-section ratio, first of all, we get rid of the luminosity. We will get rid of some dimension of this. And the theoretical prediction is amazingly precise. It has a scale uncertainty of 0.5%. But I didn't mention one thing. The cross-section is a convolution of hard scattering cross-section and PDS. The uncertainties I gave you were only the uncertainties on the hard scattering part. The PDFs contribute 4 to 5%. But now we have a tool. Because now we have a tool where we can measure this thing here precisely. We know this here very precisely, up to 1% level. So we may have a tool to actually constrain PDFs. And this is what will be done. By looking, for example, at the rapidity distribution in Z and W production, we can get new information in a new regime for the PDFs. Now, the experimental signatures, I guess you know pretty well, so I skip them. I think the important thing here is that we think we are able to measure Z and W production with a systematic uncertainty of the order of 2.5%. W is a little bit more difficult because you have more background from QCD. Because it could be that QCD jets, that one jet fakes missing energy, so it looks like a neutrino, the other jet fakes an electron, for example. So it's more difficult to get rid of QCD background, so the systematic uncertainties are a little bit larger. But the experimental uncertainty is of the order of a few percent. Now, if you want to measure the absolute cross-section, you have to add in the luminosity uncertainty. Now, in the beginning, this might be 10%. So a beautiful measurement is destroyed by a 10% uncertainty. Very ugly. So does it actually make sense to measure an absolute cross-section? Or can we turn the game around, as I just did for the PDF? And this is what we can do. Now, I skip also this take and probe. Probably you know it better than I do. It's just a way of measuring efficiency. Now, to turn the argument around for the luminosity is the following. So you count a certain number of events which give you a Z. And this is given by the luminosity times PDF times cross-section. So if you take these as inputs, because we know them at the level of 5% at the moment, if we count this here, then we could extract this here at the 5% level. If you are able to count this at the 1% level. And you've seen we are able to count these at the 1 to 2% level. So maybe we have a method then to extract the luminosity at this level. And actually in the end, for certain type of processes, there is no need to go to the machine luminosity anymore. For example, if you want to measure the number of W pair production, what you can do is you just normalize your number of events which you counted to the number of events which you counted for Z production. And then you have to compare it to a theoretical prediction, which is not an absolute prediction, but just a ratio of the predictions. So the luminosity is completely gone. There's no luminosity factor anymore. And so basically you could say I measure all other processes relative to a standard candle, the set production, which I can count very precisely. And if you think about it, basically we have measured all processes relative to Baba scattering, because the Baba scattering process was known theoretically very well. So basically we took the luminosity from the Baba scattering process and then used that number to produce cross-section for all other processes. But in the end, that's nothing else than normalizing the counting of events to the counting of Baba events. And here, basically the Z production could be the Baba process at LHC. However, be careful, this cancellation of uncertainties in the PDFs here works because, for example, WW production, like Z production, is mostly quark induced. if you want to measure gluon-induced process here, actually the cancellation might not work, or it not be so nice. So maybe you have to think about other ways of normalizing it to a gluon-induced process, which is well known. Yeah. There's an arrow here, and there's an arrow here.
As I said
here. So this has an arrow, if you take the Z cross-section, this has an arrow of the order of 5% at the moment. This has an arrow of, let's say, 1% at the moment. So overall, this is 5%. If we count this at the level of 1%, then we can extract this number at the level of 5%.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
but 5% is better than 10%.
Okay.
Unless we are able to constrain these more by other measurements or by looking at the rapidity shape, and then we can push this to, let's say, 3% or so, then you can push this now. Finally, one important process is W plus jet production. Now, W plus jet production, very often, again, the people measure the cross-section as a function, for example, of the PT of the jet, which is coming together with a W of a Z. If you do that, you have again the jet energy scale problem. Because your cross section will depend on how well you know the PT of the jet, which is coming together with a W of Z. Another way to look at this is the following. Z plus jet production, you can do the following. You can measure the PT of the Z by measuring the PT of the two leptons. And then you can measure the PT of the Z at the few percent level. Forget about the jets. You measure the PT of the Z just from the leptons. Okay? And you get a distribution. This is actually the distribution of the Z PT, for sure, which will be known at a few percent. But you can think about the following. The PT distribution of the jet, of the Z is a convolution of the distribution of Z plus 0 jet, Z plus 1 jet, Z plus 2 jets, and so on. Now this is just indicative, okay? Of course, this actually could go down here, but just to give an indication. So without looking at the hadronic side, where you have all these problems of jet energy scales, just look at the leptonic side, get a very precise measurement, and still be able to constrain QCD predictions very, very nicely. Okay. Another way of getting around experimental systematics. Skip also this. And finally, before we go to lunch, one thought about background extrapolation. This is something you should always try to think about in your analysis. Very often you have the following problem. You have an observable, and you measure the number of events as a function of this observable here. Now, it could be that your standard model background has a shape like this, could be pretty complicated, and on top of this, there is a single contribution. And now, if you just take this one here, and this single contribution is not too large, then, and if you have to rely for this background on, let's say, Monte Carlo predictions or QCD calculations, people might not believe you. Might say this is just because we don't know the background well. So how can you get the background in another way? So you can do the following. This type of distribution you have obtained by imposing cuts, which have been optimized for getting as much signal here as possible. By restricting, for example, the whole phase space just to one part of the phase space. So now do the following. You invert the cuts. So instead of looking at this part of the phase space, look at all the rest. If you look at all the rest, there is no signal, or just a little bit. But there's a lot of background, theoretically. And now you just use the data. Okay, you measure it. You might have a little contamination, but otherwise you normalize now your prediction for the background to the data. And then you can go back. You can go back from this region of phase space to this region of phase space by using theory. But now you don't use an absolute theoretical prediction. You only need the theory prediction for going from one part of the phase space to the other one. This often has a reduced systematic uncertainty. Not necessarily always. Again, if your reduction in phase space is very small and, for example, it probes very low PT physics and so on, you might have troubles with QCD calculations. Thank you. but often it is reduced. Actually, this is the generalized form of thinking of taking the background for a peak from the sidebands. Because the sidebands of a peak is nothing else than the background low phase space region. This is just a generalized form of that. So see, you're going to see and probably have seen this idea already a few times. Always think about this. It's just a sideband subtraction method in a generalized form. And this was mentioned before, the missing ET measurement is a very important observer for us, let's say SUSY. Now this is a plot by D0 of the missing ET measurement evolution with time. And if D0 just took the raw data, they got this missing ET measurement. Now if this is not SUSY discovery plus unified extra dimensions plus little Higgs plus whatever, then I don't know. Then what they did, this is just a distribution without cleaning. Then they took out all the bad runs. Bad runs could be that they knew that some subdetector had a problem during that run. For example, take out all the bad runs, then a lot of your models are already gone, because then your remain is this here. But this looks pretty nice. Still, this could still be a very broad tower of something. But then they started to remove the noisy events. Where some could be that just some photodetector was noisy during a certain period, generating this bump here. Suddenly you're here. So you approach suddenly what should be there for the standard model zone. And this plot is a very nice warning plot for your first data. So you see how easy it is to generate spectacular missing ET distributions if you do not do a careful cleaning. So the cleaning is the name of the game for missing ET at the beginning. So finally, a few warnings. Well, try to be independent from as independent from Monte Carlo as possible. Try to get background from the data. It will not be always possible. In fact, be critical with data-driven methods also, because sometimes data-driven methods have somewhere a Monte Carlo hidden. And people don't tell you that, there's a little bias correction. Be careful for this bias. Sometimes there's no other way around, but just be honest. And be careful, of course, at the tails. I gave a lot of examples. And also try to understand, if you use a Monte Carlo, or if you use a higher order QCD prediction, really try to understand what is in there, what is in the Monte Carlo. Just don't take it as a black box. Try really to put these few extra hours in understanding what is in the Monte Carlo. So, I'm at the end. We have to go to Edinburgh. And I think this is what summarizes basically the early physics. I think I have said most of it. You can skip to it. So I think we are pretty much prepared. I hope there are not too many negative surprises, but a lot of positive surprises during the next few months. And that's the end. Thanks.
Sticking everything in, but I'm sure we all appreciate it, getting all the principles right. Is there one question that doesn't go in? Yes.
Thank you for your multiple partner interaction. How will this PCMA?
Well, there are some ideas, and in fact, basically also picking up ideas from the Tevatron. For example, looking at 4-jet production, but actually where I can identify that two pairs of two jets in the 4-jet production are pretty well balanced in PT, because this gets contribution from multi-pattern interaction. Another way of looking at it probably is by looking at same sign W production, which you have to do it in this way. You cannot get it from PP interaction.
You are not looking for this main.
This I was going to say, and this is I think one thing which Tevatron now has indication that actually in order to describe the multiplicity as a function of this PT, you have to add in some contribution, probably from multi-pattern interaction. So I guess all this will try to be just repeated as quickly as possible.
Okay, so I think we've run out of time, but it's been a real pleasure and privilege to listen to talk about the first physics from the others.
I'll be on the bus for questions.
Okay, that's what you asked. Okay. Right, so let's start.